Welcome to The Independent with Scott Atlas, brought to you by The Independent Institute, my show that tries to bring a uniquely rational perspective to some of the most important and controversial issues facing us today. Today's guest is Molly Hemingway. Molly is the editor-in-chief of The Federalist, a senior journalism fellow at Hillsdale College, and a frequent contributor to Fox News, regularly featured on Bret Baier's Special Report. She's the co-author and author of several books, including Justice on Trial, The Kavanaugh Confirmation, and The Future of the Supreme Court, Rigged, How the Media, Big Tech, and the Democrats Seized Our Elections, and the just-released book, Alito, The Justice Who Reshaped the Supreme Court and Restored the Constitution. When asked why students should study journalism, Molly said, quote, "An informed citizenry is vitally important to the health of the republic. As the journalism profession deteriorates, good reporters with an interest in truth-telling are more important than ever," unquote. Molly and I have a conversation about the Supreme Court today and some of the other issues facing it. Thanks for joining us and stay tuned. Okay, Molly Hemingway, welcome.
It's great to be here with you, Scott.
Very, very interested in your book, Alito, The Justice Who Reshaped the Supreme Court and Restored the Constitution, because this is a person who is so impactful, but really sort of under the radar to me. So I'm really glad you wrote the book. And I want to start by going through a little bit about his background and what shaped him. You note in the book that he's an Italian-American immigrant with his roots in one of those types of towns, Trenton, New Jersey. And apparently his parents emphasized education early on, which many of our immigrant family parents did, of course. How did that contribute, do you think, to his sort of commitment to originalism and the rule of law?
Well, I think one of the things that comes out with Samuel Alito early in life is he's a good student. He's a good athlete. He is in a bunch of clubs and activities. But what he really excels in are things that make sense, you know, logical things. He enjoys languages. He enjoys debate. And he also, in his upbringing, has a father who's like this one-man congressional research service for the New Jersey State Legislature. And in that role, he had to serve both Democrats and Republicans. Nobody knew what his politics were. And there was a Supreme Court decision that required New Jersey to not allocate its Senate in the same way that the United States has its Senate configured. So he had to personally, the father, had to personally redraw New Jersey's electoral districts and do it in a way that would pass muster at a constitutional convention with both Republicans and Democrats. And he does this, and younger Sam Alito is upstairs just hearing them clacking away on his number machine. To do this, by the way, I think shows how remarkable his father was. To do this on his own takes an incredible amount of brilliance and dedication. And he just learns that the Supreme Court has decisions that affect people like my dad. In debate, he starts getting topics that deal with the Constitution. And he just starts thinking deeply about what the Constitution is. And he wouldn't have identified himself as an originalist then, and even not until much later. But the seeds of it were there at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. There's another thing that's unique about Sam Alito, and that is that he has military service. The only one, I think, on the Supreme Court. How important is that, and what impact does that really have on him and his thinking about these sorts of issues, perhaps even the military issues?
Right. I think this current Supreme Court, many people would say, is of one of the highest calibers that we've ever seen a Supreme Court be at. I mean, they are incredibly smart people. We've been seeing this now for quite a few years, that extremely smart and dedicated people are put on the court, with a few notable exceptions. But they're all a little more academic and theoretical than someone like Sam Alito is, also renowned for his brilliance. His colleagues use that word to describe him a lot. But when he goes to Princeton, he gets a low draft number. He decides to enter ROTC because he knows he's going to be drafted, and he thinks that's the best course of action for him. But it wasn't just being in the military and training and, you know, spending his summers training and going into the military. It was also what happened at his school in reaction to military service. it ends up getting so bad that the ROTC can't meet at Princeton. There are riots. There are protests. And he realizes that he, a public school kid who's gotten there because he's smart and hardworking, is at school with a bunch of people who are there because their dads went there and they're rich and they went to the top boarding schools, but that doesn't mean that they're competing with him intellectually. And so, you know, he has this personal experience that's very different in terms of his connection to people who do serve in the military, but it also helps him, I think, see things in a military way. His clerks say he frequently talks about things in terms of the military. We don't need to take point on this issue. Like, he uses the lingo. He wants his clerks to understand that there is a battle for America, of what kind of America we're going to have, and they should view themselves as part of that battle.
Yeah, before I go on to that point, because I think this sort of battle positioning is very interesting about the way he talks to and works with his clerks. I want to ask about this, his background. And, you know, I have a similar sort of background of an immigrant family, and I was first one to go to college, and my family's in the generation. And I personally think of elites a certain way. Even though my whole career has been in these elitist institutions, I'm sort of very anti-elitist. And I wonder if that is how you would describe Alito.
I think it's interesting that you're picking up on that, you know, personally as well, because he is a product of elite institutions. Princeton, Yale Law. He enters the Department of Justice as a career employee, but he becomes a political appointee. He's a politically appointed U.S. attorney. He's a federal judge. But somehow he's never one of them, and he doesn't want to be one of them. And I think, you know, I do think that Princeton experience taught him. He thought when he went to Princeton, it was going to be this situation where he would be struggling to keep up with these people who he'd always been told were his betters. And he does not find that at all. And he doesn't care about Washington, D.C. politics. But I also think it's like deeper in the sense that he grew up, like you mentioned, in Trenton and outside of Trenton, and he sees what liberal elite policies have done to the places he loves. And he sees how they're all protected from it. Not his family, not the people he knows, where when you have certain big policy positions that will never hurt the income levels of the elite, maybe they'll even help them, but they do hurt poor and middle-class people. Crime rates hurt poor and middle-class people so much more than they hurt the normal top earners. And it makes him just realize, I don't think these people care about people like my family and other people.
Mm-hmm. So let me get back to this idea that he views things as a battle. And I think you say his clerks are told literally this is a war for the Constitution's survival. Let me hear more about that. And is that unique among the justices, or is that something that others are sort of also doing?
I would say it's something that Thomas also sees. And you see some similarities between Justice Thomas's clerks and Justice Alito's clerks. Everybody hires their own clerks. These are the elite law students from elite law schools who each serve a one-year term. Some people like Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Brett Kavanaugh, they just pretty much hire the top students from the top schools. And it's a beautiful credential to get to clerk at the Supreme Court. The moment you leave, you immediately start making more than the justice for whom you clerked.
Yeah, it's the most prestigious thing you can do post-law school, I think.
Right. And so they just get the top students and they work with them. For a Justice Thomas and a Justice Alito, they're picking people who understand that there is this battle for the country, for the Constitution. And Justice Alito, he wants people who are not going to just cash out at the end of their clerkship. He wants them to be also part of this effort that for which money actually can be a barrier. He's always been a public servant. His father, always a public servant. This is a man. Alito is a man who could be making tens of millions of dollars off the court every single year. He's got that kind of mind to handle complex litigation. And actually, all the justices could be making much more. And I understand that there's power there, too. But it takes a certain sacrifice for the benefit of other people. And that's what he wants. And he's gotten that. There are a lot of clerks he's had who become federal judges, who are top academics, solicitors general, doing the type of legal work that helps out religious groups that's not necessarily high paying. So he's gotten what he's wanted there too.
Would you describe him as a very religious man?
You know, he is. He was born and raised Roman Catholic, and he is a regular worshiper. You know, yes, I would, but in that way that used to be actually quite normal for Americans, not in a way that you would think of as, you know, super, like Justice Thomas goes to mass every day, I believe. So he's, you know, very, very religious. You know, I think Justice Scalia was also very religious. And you do kind of get a sense that there's a difference in the justices who are religious and those who aren't.
Mm-hmm. You made a comment that you describe Alito as a judge's judge. What does that mean? And why is he like that, really?
Before he was named to the Supreme Court, it was Judge Alito, and he'd served on the Third Circuit, which covers New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Delaware, for 15 years. And when you're a lower court judge, you're dealing with what the Supreme Court says in how you apply the law to the cases that come before you. He cares deeply about the decisions being clear and able to be accurately applied by lower court judges. It's this practicality that distinguishes him from some of the other justices. The other justices, and this is like no knock against them because I actually tend to this myself, they're very philosophical. They're very theoretical. If they see a First Amendment case, they just want to be as broad as they can. Well, the First Amendment says you can't restrict speech, so this isn't going to work. Alito more looks at the particulars of a case before him. He learned this from the judge he clerked for, Leonard Garth, that the facts of the case can provide a way to settle a dispute for that case. And he's thinking this way because not just was he a federal judge for 15 years, he was also the U.S. attorney, he was a prosecutor, and knowing how to apply the law fairly and accurately and consistently, he thinks the whole point of the courts is to establish order. And so he wants to be part of that on the Supreme Court as well.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about this concept of originalism. I've read a lot of books on Scalia, frankly. And, you know, the three people who are in my mind the originalists, if you want to say that, are in our recent history are Scalia, Clarence Thomas, and Alito. So I want to get sort of your take on the comparing these three. And let's start with, you're very knowledgeable now. You've written several books on the Supreme Court. First, define what does it mean to be an originalist?
Well, if I can just back it up a tiny bit, it comes in response to decades of the court acting basically as a legislature. They would just rule on the law according to what their current feelings were. And they were quite open about it. Justice Brennan said, that's what he does. He rules according to what he thinks it should be. And different people, I think Thurgood Marshall maybe was the one who said the only rule he cares about is rule of five. And so you saw a lot of decisions that weren't based in the law, they were based in feelings, and it was causing problems. The conservative legal movement really gets started in response to some of this. There are other streams that lead up to it, but you have during the Reagan administration, it's the official policy of Reagan that they're going to try to move the courts into what they call a more originalist direction. All they mean by that is instead of going based on our feelings, which is rule of man, we're going to go based on our laws, the Constitution should be interpreted according to what we all signed on to at the time. What was the meaning of that word at the time that it was passed? So just a way of providing order and making sure, again, that the laws are being fairly interpreted and applied. So Scalia is one of those fathers of the originalist movement. And he's also beloved because he wasn't just this amazing scholar. And by the way, his work on textualism, which is separate, but if I could just do a little diversion
sure,
here, 25% of the cases that come before the Supreme Court deal with the Constitution. Three quarters deal with statutes. So how do you interpret statutes? And Scalia also literally wrote the book on textualism and how to interpret statutes in a way that is not, again, rule of man, but rule of law. So he's not just this amazing mind and brilliant scholar and has a great track record as a federal judge before he becomes a Supreme Court justice. He's also one of the most enjoyable writers I have ever read. He's delightful to read. He's vicious, but in a really fun way. And he just makes reading Supreme Court. I think that might actually be why I got into reading Supreme Court opinions, because I never missed one of his opinions or dissents.
You're talking about Scalia now.
Scalia. Yeah, because they were so fun to read.
Yeah, it's amazing. He's so witty in his application of logic to things that it's, in fact, I'm going to say I just recently read a book, The Essential Scalia, which goes through on sort of a topic-oriented approach, his decisions, his writings, and some of his speeches on these issues. It's really amazing, and I'm very concerned, and we can talk about this, that there's a void, as there is a void in our society when some of these great minds like Milton Friedman, Ronald Reagan, Thatcher, these people don't exist. And I personally feel there is a void of leadership, and Scalia is one of these guys that are just so important historically. But I want to get back, before I get your reaction on that, to this idea of originalism, because there's a concept that the Constitution is an out-of-date document, and it's a living document. And originalism, contrary to what some people criticize it as, in my view, originalism is not just saying we don't make a transition to how current day is. We do. Scalia always did. I mean, there were no cell phones, there was no electronic media, but it's still an application based on what the original intent of the law was at the time. And originalism is, we're not there, we the justices, to make new laws. Like you said, it's not a legislative branch. And I think when you have that, as opposed to what people, I think, on the left are saying, that they're worried about the power of the Supreme Court. The power of the Supreme Court is magnified enormously if you allow them to remake the law. Then you get a tiny group of people who are not elected, who are not answerable to the public, who are in a position of making new laws.
And that's the trend you have seen with this court. You now have 5 members of the court who openly state that they are originalist, and the 6th one who doesn't say that, but who shares an important precept with them, which is, in fact, the people should decide things more than the court. That would be Chief Justice John Roberts. So all 6 of the Republican appointed justices are trying to devolve things back to the people in one way or another. That is a less political court.
Right.
Because they're saying, we're just 9 people who weren't even elected. We shouldn't be deciding these things. The people should be deciding these things. And yet, because the court had engaged in this activism and saying, oh, we found hidden in the 14th Amendment, we can't tell you precisely where, but there's clearly the founders said that abortion should be legal throughout the country. I mean, they would make things up that were just preposterous. And that was the thing that hurt the country and made the court more powerful than it should be. Returning things to the people is a really, you know, I don't think people appreciate it enough right now. And I know there are legitimate complaints about the court. I certainly have them myself. But overall, this is a much, much better court than at any time in the last, you know, 120 years minimum.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little more directly about comparing Alito, Thomas, and Scalia in terms of, you know, they're obviously very different personalities, but go ahead, let us know.
Well, people know so much about Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas, and rightly so. They are, you know, just these larger than life figures. Justice Thomas's personal story is one of the most incredible in our nation's history. And he's also this amazing mind. He and Justice Alito tend to vote together. Same could be said of Justice Scalia when he was on the bench. They do tend to vote in the same way, and yet they have these differences. I think we saw a recent decision that explains a little bit about how that works. There was a massive case, that decision that was handed down about the Voting Rights Act. And the Voting Rights Act had a section that was interpreted in just kind of crazy ways by lower federal courts. They said that you could be racist when you put together a gerrymandered district if you're a Democrat, but you can't be racist to put together a gerrymandered district if you're a Republican. Obviously, this was something that Democrats wisely exploited, and they created all these racist gerrymandered districts. Well, sometimes the federal courts would say, you have to do it.
When you say racist, you mean race-based gerrymandered districts.
Yes. So a case came before the court, and there was a decision authored by Alito. Clarence Thomas joined that. He also wrote a concurrence. You know, he said, I agree, but I'd like to point this thing out too, that was signed on with Gorsuch, who's another one of these big originalists. And Thomas would have taken a much more extreme position. He would have said, actually, the Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, like the whole thing is a mess. Gerrymandered districts are a mess. We shouldn't allow them. We shouldn't be, you know, hearing these cases. Alito takes, he might even agree with Thomas on this, but he knows that you're not going to get a majority with this kind of pure philosophical viewpoint. So he puts together a majority based on a reading that says clearly the Voting Rights Act doesn't say to be racist because the 15th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution forbids racism from the states. So it couldn't be interpreted, you know, it had been falsely interpreted as requiring these race-based districts. And he upholds the Voting Rights Act by pointing to the Constitution. This gets six justices on board. So it's a real powerhouse opinion. And Thomas, being, you know, I think he's also fun to read, and he's so efficient with his words. He just says it, gets it done, gets out. But they work together well. Thomas will plant his flag and say, we should be way over here. And Alito says, I agree, but we're not going to get there by just saying that. We're going to get there by slowly moving the court, or, you know, maybe not even slowly, but just regularly moving the court in the better direction.
Mm-hmm. Again, owing to this description of a practical originalist that you mentioned, in the Dobbs opinion, which of course is one of the most controversial opinions, or at least was, you know, it seems every day there's something the most controversial ever. But Thomas assigned the Dobbs opinion to Alito, correct, to write. First of all, why? And sort of, I'd like you to extrapolate from that into their sort of, their personal relationship that you can glean.
Right. So just the basic background there would be whoever has seniority in the majority or in the dissent, you know, assigns the opinion. He can take it for himself or he can give it to someone else.
So that's not assigned by the chairman of the Supreme Court, meaning Robert.
It is if the chief is in the majority.
Okay.
But he wasn't in the majority in the case of Dobbs. So Dobbs, and I tell the whole backstory in the book about, you know, what happened with abortion jurisprudence over the years and what a big strain it was on the Supreme Court and how the particular Dobbs case makes it to the court. And they hear oral argument on December 1st, 2021. And shortly thereafter, they vote on where they stand. You have five justices saying that they want to uphold the state statute that protected some children at some point of gestation. Oh, sorry, you had six justices who said that the state statute from Mississippi was good. And that included all six Republican-appointed justices. But only five of them, so Thomas, Alito, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Barrett, said that they would also overturn Roe v. Wade. Now, this had been a goal of the conservative legal movement for 50 years. Pro-lifers and non-pro-lifers just said, it's not law. It's not based in the law. It's a bad decision. It needs to go.
Right. There's no founding of it in the Constitution.
Yeah. And people had known that for a long time, but it took courage to keep everything together. And previously, when the court had almost overturned Roe v. Wade, something would happen. The pressure campaign would get too intense and they wouldn't do it. So Thomas, as the senior member of the majority, has to assign the opinion. Does he keep it for himself or does he give it to one of the other four? Well, he already had a huge gun rights case that term that was going to be a heavy lift. And he also understood that history. He'd been on the court when there had been previous problems with overturning Roe. He knew the decision had to be perfectly done to keep a majority together under unbelievable pressure. So he signs it to Alito. That's what he does. He doesn't really care when he's working with, like, if he's writing something solo, he's writing it solo and he's got every word exactly how he wants it. If he's working to keep a majority together, he's very generous with that. If someone wants a particular section that he doesn't think is necessary, he puts it in there. If someone wants a paragraph worded a particular way, he has no problem with it. And he also makes sure to get all of their arguments together, even when they are difficult to join together. So Clarence Thomas has unique views on the 14th Amendment. He basically thinks the Supreme Court has been wrong about how it's applied the 14th Amendment for more than 100 years. Well, the other justices are not going to agree with him on that. But it means that when you're referring to the 14th Amendment, you have to be careful to keep Thomas there without moving the other justices away. And so Alito, he just has that ability and he did it and he obviously did it. And they could not have gone through more than they went through, including active threats on their lives from people who did not want them to do the right thing.
Yeah, you talk about the leaks, these incredible leaks, really, of that Dobbs decision, as well as apparently there was some slow walking for several weeks. Meantime, there was all kinds of death threats to the conservative justices. Give us some information on what happened during that and also how Alito dealt with that whole thing. There was a tremendous amount of pressure, probably more than in any other decision in our lifetimes.
Not even close. This is far and away the most pressure they've ever gone through. This, for me, was the most explosive part of the book. You know, I'm out there intending to write a biography of Sam Alito, and I discover these things and report them that are, you know, for me, they were truly shocking. So we all knew that that Dobbs decision was leaked. Almost immediately, you have firebombings at churches and pro-life centers. You have protests breaking out at each one of the Dobbs justices at their homes, and they're being moved to secure locations. They are having to wear bulletproof vests. I mean, it was a very bad situation. So when the nine justices meet in conference shortly thereafter, and that's where it's just the nine of them, nobody else is there, Alito actually asks, like, you've known what you were going to be doing, dealing with here for many, many months. We've been done with our opinion since early February. Could you get your dissent out? And that's because a decision isn't final from the Supreme Court until it's handed down publicly. In order to be handed down publicly, that almost always means you have to have the opinion, but anything else, dissents, concurrences. So they're just waiting on them. They've been ready since February. And Justice Gorsuch was like, well, they demur. They don't agree to get it done quickly. And Justice Gorsuch says, do you think you could give us a date by which you will be done? And they couldn't. And as I report in the book, you even had Justice Kagan going to Breyer's chambers and screaming at him not to accommodate his conservative colleagues by getting the dissent done.
Not to put it out.
Yes. And Breyer, you know, couldn't be more liberal, but he cared about his colleagues. And, he seemed like he wanted to accommodate them. But you know that they didn't, because they don't get their dissent done until June. And then when they do finally get it done, they include this absolutely gratuitous mention of a decision that really is still being worked on and won't be released for several weeks. It's not released for several weeks. So from start of leak to finish, it was 7 weeks that these justices had to deal with death threats. And you might remember Justice Kavanaugh had an attempted assassin at his home.
Yes.
So it wasn't just an idle threat. I mean, these were real problems they were dealing with.
To me, it's even worse than that, because this is the job. You don't just stall on releasing the dissent. Is this something that is unprecedented? I mean, has this happened in the past?
I don't know if it has, but I think it's a reflection of how frustrated the liberal justices are. You know, if things had gone slightly differently, you remember Scalia dies in 2016. Everybody expects Hillary Clinton to become the president. Had she replaced Scalia with someone liberal and then been able to replace other justices, even keeping a Ginsburg seat open for Kevin Ginsburg replaced by another liberal, you'd be having a radically different court. And Elena Kagan would be the head of it, the intellectual head of it. And instead, she is the lone liberal who's taken seriously by the conservative justices. She's got this vote of one. Her fellow liberals aren't very persuasive. They're not building groups like she can. And it's got to be frustrating. She's also far and away the most political member of the court. Everyone else had a background as a federal judge. She has a background as a politician, or as a political person for Obama. And she is very good at politics. And I think when you don't have much power, you start doing other things. Maybe you delay your dissent because it's the only thing you can do. We had reports that she also did this in the Voting Rights Act case, which had been argued all the way back in October. The majority opinion had been done for a long time, also by Alito. And there was reporting she was slow walking it to the end of the term. She actually gets it out at the end of April. But I kind of wonder if the fact that everyone knew she was slow walking things made her get it out, even if she was delaying it, it forced her to get it out a little bit earlier. And then she's also taken to undermining the court publicly. That is a huge norm that has been broken by the current liberals on the court. you know, we talked about Scalia and how witty he was. Well, he would put these biting things in his opinions and dissents. He would mock people who didn't agree with him, but then they would all go out and have beer or, you know, drinks, and it was all fine. The current liberal justices, they are publicly deriding their colleagues and the integrity of the court. That is a very dangerous norm for them to have broken, I think.
Yeah, I mean, this to me is really eye-opening, shocking. Particularly, again, I've read several books by Scalia. And one of the things about Scalia is that he was good friends with Ginsburg and Kagan. And I think it was Kagan that wrote the preface to this book, The Essential Scalia, that I was mentioning. And, you know, she talked about how he was so charming and funny, and anything he wrote was worth reading. This whole sort of intellectual honesty and civility really is gone. And maybe it's just mirroring the country. I'm sort of down on the absence of civility in the United States these days. I think it's really horrific. And it's really something of a different topic, the violence that we see, that's the political reaction to people who disagree with you. But to see it on the Supreme Court is a break in the norms that we have grown up with.
I do think, though, that we can also look to the court for how well they have handled things. Shortly after the leak, you might remember Justice Thomas said that he really was worried that there was a decrease in the amount of civility on the court from when he had joined. I think that is true. It's also true that, particularly considering that they've had to deal with all these problems, you know, like death threats that their liberal colleagues didn't help with, it still remains pretty civil. Even when Sonia Sotomayor went after Justice Kavanaugh recently, said some really mean things about him, what did the court do? All of Kavanaugh's colleagues insisted that she apologize, and she did. So seeing even that, it gives me a little bit of hope. I wish she hadn't done it in the first place, but I am glad she apologized, and I'm glad that Kavanaugh's colleagues demanded it, because they do care about being able to get along. And, you know, these are nine people who have to work together for their lifetime terms. And so I think they have built up habits of civility that endure. And I think we all could stand to also, you know, work on those habits of civility.
What do you think about Alito's personal relationship with the liberal justices? Again, possibly comparing it to the Scalia mode, where Scalia was a unique guy with a unique personality. But Alito is sort of depicted, in my view, as just a simple observer, as somebody who's a lot drier and sort of not so personable, if you want to use that word. What is his relationship with the liberal justices on the court?
So when he was nominated, there was a reporter who did not know anything about him who got this term going that just could not be less accurate. He said Alito was Scalito, that this was yet another Italian, just like Scalia, who's going to be put on the court. Well, there are similarities. They both are, you know, these Italians from New Jersey, and Scalia grew up in New York.
Yeah. I mean, I don't do that kind of stuff as much in terms of similarity, but the liberal leftist side of our country loves to categorize people that way. So that fits perfectly.
But they couldn't have been more different. I mean, Scalia is this massive, outgoing personality. When Alito joins the court, I think he said, you know, how unusual, a shy Supreme Court justice of Alito. Alito is extremely, extremely reserved. I mean, you could say shy. He's very quiet. Like, he gets energy from reading books and law review articles, not from other people. If he's with other people, he's very deferential to them. He wants to hear what they have to say. He's not going to command a room. And so you're just having a very different climate. But he does get along with the other justices, and he's very, you know, orderly and civil. But I also learned from a lot of clerks from other chambers that everyone comes on the court expecting Alito to be this dour and just a conservative kind of guy. And they all leave saying that he far and away changed their opinion from their impression the most. He's a very big guy, tall, athletic. He loves baseball. He loves talking about baseball.
Big Phillies fan.
Yes. And he has the driest sense of humor, which he deploys to great effect. And so the clerks from other chambers frequently say, just like, oh, he impressed me more than any other justice, in part because I think they had low expectations going in part because nobody ever talks about him, which is basically why I wrote the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's sort of interesting and this is what you're writing, he's reshaped the court. He's a pivotal figure in restoring the Constitution. And I sort of find that it's almost like it's the other side of the coin of someone who is reserved and under the radar. Were you surprised, or did you go in thinking that this is a guy who's so impactful and book must be written?
So when Carrie Severino and I wrote that book on Justice Kavanaugh, there were so many high-level people who said that Alito was this giant that I already, that was kind of why I thought it needed to be written. His own colleagues would say, he's the best at oral argument. He's brilliant. He's like, why does nobody talk about him? There's never been a book about him until this year. He's been on the court for 20 years. Even Ketanji Brown Jackson has books about her and by her, and she's only been on the court for a couple years. But I did already know that people I respected would frequently say, Alito's the one, Alito's the one. And I did want to point out one other thing about difference between him and Scalia. So Scalia, so pure in his thinking and theoretical in his thinking, and he really did not care if other people were with him or not. And there's something to admire about that. But if there were a decision and you had to moderate to keep a majority together, Alito would not do that. And I think Thomas understands the need to be part of a majority that he doesn't totally agree with, but he's also got some of that, like he knows he's right, and he is. Usually, almost always. And he doesn't, that's what he cares about, being right. I remember one justice said something about a line about a guy who would rather be right than be president. I forget who that famous figure is, but applied that to Scalia. He'd rather be right than be in the majority.
Yeah, I think I can identify with that, but that's not necessarily a positive. So let's finish up with this question, because it's been in the news, I think, quite a bit. And it's all speculation, but this idea that somehow Alito is thinking about retiring, did anything come up that indicated that, or is that just a media hype sort of thing, or what's the status of this?
It's partly just a speculation game that people play for political reasons, meaning each president during their presidency wants to have some replacements. Appointing a Supreme Court member is one of the most consequential things you do. Trump had great success with his three, and they're just doing basic planning. You also have a bunch of people. This is one of the things I didn't quite realize until I started covering the Supreme Court was how much campaigning goes into becoming a member of the Supreme Court. Not all of them. I wouldn't say Thomas or Alito. I mean, Alito famously did not campaign for it, but a lot of them do, or have teams of people who campaign on their behalf. And so the campaigns had definitely begun. There are people who would like to replace Alito or Thomas or Roberts if and when he retires. So it's partly just that, but not that it came from Alito. He has given no indication that he is at the point of retiring. You know, it might be within the next few years. I don't know. And even though his chambers got word out that he wasn't, I technically don't know. But I wouldn't be shocked if there were a retirement this year. Although, you know, I still keep on thinking it could be Thomas. It could even be the chief. But maybe none. Maybe none this year.
Do you think that it's totally speculative, but that the judges, the justices, when they contemplate retiring, are they contemplating the timing of their retirement as much as we sort of think or are led to believe in terms of who's in charge of the next appointment?
Absolutely. So Ruth Bader Ginsburg was pressured to retire under Obama, but she really wanted Hillary to pick her replacement. She thought that was important that, you know, she was very into identity. And so she wanted, as a woman, to have a woman name her replacement. And that did not work out well because Trump was elected. And then at the end of his first term, she dies. So she was thinking about it for political reasons. Souter, you know, he retired under a Democrat, even though he was appointed by a Republican, because he felt more comfortable with the Democrat Party. Some people, they actually just think it's inappropriate for justices to think in terms of politics and that they should just make a decision independently. And they even think that when you're making a decision for political reasons, it reduces the integrity of the Supreme Court. So it's just, you get all types. And then you also have Breyer, who was pressured off of the court by a Democrat activism campaign, and he was replaced by Ketanji Brown Jackson. He really wasn't ready to go, and he has told his former colleagues, like, don't retire. Nobody cares about you when you retire. So I think if people do want to pressure people off the court, they might think about continuing to pay honor to justices who did the type of legal interpretation that they like.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Molly, we'll leave it there. It's fascinating. It's really a great book and great timing. There's so many issues that we could have spoken about. Maybe we'll have you back.
Sounds great, Scott. Thanks for having me here.
Great. Thank you. Thanks for listening to The Independent with Scott Atlas. If you want to find out more about today's guest, Molly Hemingway, follow her work as commentator on the news and as editor-in-chief of The Federalist, and importantly, read her new book, Alito. And don't forget to subscribe to this show on YouTube, Spotify, Apple, and anywhere else you're listening to podcasts right now, and I'll see you next time.